Hello and welcome to Philosoph India. I'm Tejas Aralere, and I hope to make Indian philosophy accessible to all of you through my podcasts. My goal is to give you a chronological summary of the different philosophical schools that came to exist in India. There are six orthodox schools of philosophy, so I will try to explain the historical context in which these schools came to exist, and also explain kind of where they came from, so the historical background of them. Where they came from is a very complex question that requires investigating multiple other texts and scriptures, which I will also try to do. As a student of the subject myself, I can't promise that everything I say will be 100% perfect. There are going to be mistakes, hopefully very, very few, and I'm going to do my research meticulously to ensure that as much of it is accurate as possible. But my main goal is to make the world of ancient Indian history and philosophy easily accessible to you. As long as you get the basic ideas and the basic tenets of the different schools, I'll be happy. I'm trying to use this podcast as an introduction for you guys for Eastern thought, right? So mainly Indian philosophy. So if you listen to this and you get more interested in one of the topics, and my goal is to just get you to at least go to the Wikipedia page and check it out and say, okay, here's what's going on. He didn't cover it, but I want to know more about it. That's more than wonderful. I just want to get you to start thinking about these ancient thoughts, because Western philosophy has a very good following, I guess, in America, but Eastern philosophy, not so much, especially Indian philosophy. While the Greeks were doing their things, Indians were doing other things too. So I think it's important to bring that to light. If you are more knowledgeable on the subject, so if you're some sort of an academic on the topic, or if you just like doing this in your spare time, too, kind of like me, please contact me if you have any questions or comments or corrections on the information I say in these podcasts. Email me at philosophindia@gmail.com. So just the name of the podcast at gmail.com. On the other hand, if there's something that I mentioned or went over too quickly and you want me to go in more detail about it in the next podcast, let me know and I can upload a smaller podcast, or I'll just include more information about it in the next podcast that I put out there. Because questions are very important. Thank God this isn't a real radio show where you can call in live, because I probably won't know the answer and I'm going to have to go look it up. But if you ask me these questions, they'll help me learn more about the topic. And I think over time, it'll make this podcast series a lot better. So once again, thanks for downloading the podcast and let's get started. The first topic to discuss is definitely the most ancient set of religious texts in the world, and this set of texts is called the Vedas. But what exactly are they, and why are they important? So first, the word Veda itself, right? So the word itself means knowledge, Veda, knowledge. It comes from the same linguistic root as the Latin word video, so the vid root. And I feel like video means in Latin, it means to see. So video, I see. I feel like the two meanings of this root, so knowledge in Sanskrit, and then video from Latin, I feel like the two of them together give the best definition of the word Veda, because there's an aspect of visible knowledge, which is what the Vedas are. They weren't just written down by a poet. They're believed to have been composed by these sages who were seers, and they were called rishis, and they had these divine visions of the absolute, and by means of those visions, they were able to understand the true meaning of life, and that is what the Vedas are. These rishis had seen God and had therefore accumulated this divine knowledge, or had access to this divine knowledge that the average person wasn't able to get. And so that's why they're so important. So Veda isn't just knowledge, it's knowledge that was seen by these seers, and that's why it's so important. The fact that it was divinely inspired, that is the most important part about it. I assume that if you've ever taken a basic world religions class, either in undergraduate college, or if you didn't do that in college and you just did basic religion in your history classes in high school, you've heard of this set of texts. But I'm almost positive that you didn't read any of them because they're in Sanskrit. So Sanskrit is the ancient Indian language that is still alive and living, mainly because of these religious texts. And all Hindu texts, originally, the most ancient ones, are all written in Sanskrit. This is India's first language. So it's an ancient language, but it's still alive. So people still speak it. There's an organization called Samskrita Bharati, so which means like the Sanskrit India. And so that organization is full of these genius computer scientists and engineers, all these young people about 25, 30, and then, also really old people. But it was so cool. I was in Bangalore, which is where my family's from in India, and they were having a convention. So I said, "Mom, we should go." So we went, we walked around, and there are all these people who are 6, 7 years older than me speaking fluently in Sanskrit. Just chatting with their friends just blew my mind. So, in case you thought Sanskrit is an ancient language and is dead, just know that it isn't. Know that there are people who are still speaking it. There are still towns in India where Sanskrit is the predominantly spoken language. It's rare, but it's still alive. So, this language is very important. Anyway, the Vedas are all written in Sanskrit. So, the first Veda, there are four of them. The first Veda, the Rig Veda, is broken up into 10 different books called mandalas. Now, each mandala has hymns, and those are called suktas, and they are all metrically arranged based on a specific number of feet or padas, and there are a specific number of feet allowed in each different meter. So, just like if you've done poetry, if you've studied poetry, and especially if you've done any of the Latin poetry or Greek poetry, you know that there are different meters that allow different amounts of syllables or feet to be in them. So those rhythmic patterns, that was all still going on here, and it's all still preserved. So a different rishi, one of those seers, is responsible for each of the 10 mandalas, and that's how it's usually accredited. Even though they were all divinely inspired, over the years, an individual rishi was given authorship or accredited with authorship over a single mandala of the Rig Veda. And so, of the four, the first one, the Rig Veda, is the most important. The Rig Veda consists mainly of these hymns of praise for different Vedic deities. And within that, though, within the Rig Veda is given instructions on how to offer sacrifice to the gods, and the story of the creation of the universe as we know it is given in that. So there's a lot contained in the Rig Veda. And then the rest of the three Vedas, which followed, use portions of the Rig Veda itself. So they take the hymns and they reorder them, and then they are used, those other Vedas are used for different purposes. So for now, I'm going to not talk about the Vedas, and I'm going to talk more about early Indian history to give you an idea of where the Vedas came from. And I think doing that will help you understand more about the things that are actually in the Veda. So that's really why I'm going to go into the history about it for a little bit, give you some context, and then we'll go into the Vedas themselves and talk about what's in them. A lot of early Indian history is unknown, but there are over 1,000 sites that have been excavated by archaeologists along the Indus River Valley. And within those 1,000 sites or so, there are more than 1,000, within all of those sites, there are two that stand out as the largest cities. These are Mohenjo-Daro and Harappa. They were in their heyday in about 2600 BC, and all these sites are in the northwestern part of India, of ancient India, that is currently now part of Pakistan. So this civilization was really very advanced. It was on par with ancient Egypt and Mesopotamia in certain aspects, and certain aspects it seems very lacking, but that could only be because we don't have a lot of the archaeological evidence that we have preserved in places like Egypt, because these people didn't have extravagant tombs and things like that to give us very detailed glimpses of their culture. It seems just as the people in the Mediterranean had, and the Egyptians, the people who settled here were also river huggers. They lived and they farmed primarily on the banks of the Indus River, which flows from many tributaries coming from the foothills of the Himalayas, and they all converge into a single river, which is the Indus. So this river flows along the border of Tibet, northwest, and then it curves northwest in a big loop, and then finally heads south along the length of Pakistan, all the way down, and empties itself into the Arabian Sea. It's still highly irrigated, and without its existence, that entire region would essentially be in an uninhabitable desert. So when you look at a map of the locations of the Mohenjo-Daro and the Harappan site, you see that they're located literally on the banks of the river, right? And it makes sense, just like any other great civilization. They needed a fertile place to begin farming. We don't know anything much about their daily lives or their social structure, but they had planned a pretty big city, right? So that comes out to about 0.7 square miles. And the city, so this isn't huge, but it's not tiny. It's not a village. So it's the biggest of the different archaeological sites that have been found. The city had a very complex system of orthogonal roads, and there were brick houses, and some of these houses had very thick brick walls. The city itself had a very thick brick wall surrounding it, and there are different theories on why. It could be, was it because they were fending off, invaders? Was it because of flooding? More likely, yes. It was probably because of the flooding from the river, which they expected and they learned to expect and learned to live with because they needed it for their crops. But you'll see in the archaeological texts that once you start looking at these houses, they're big, tall, multiple-story houses, and sometimes the walls of the houses themselves are 7 feet thick of solid brick, which is pretty over the top. Why did they need these very strong walls? Well, clearly they were building to stick around for a while, and they were also probably protecting themselves, their individual houses, from the flooding. There was probably also some fighting with the neighboring cities and towns. There isn't a lot of evidence, and there's no literary evidence for any of this, but we can guess that that was happening. Maybe for access to water, access to different parts of the river, for irrigation purposes, and even just for use of water within the city. They didn't have any piping or any water canal sort of system. It's thought that they would collect the water. There are wells that have been found, but mainly that they would get the water, take it to their home, and use it. So no running taps or anything like that, or public fountains. They were just wells. And the most important thing is they had an idea of drainage. They underneath the roads, they made these drainage sewers that run clean out of the city and don't mix with any of the fresh water. And within the houses themselves, there are sometimes some of the bigger houses have bathrooms in which there's a drainage pipe from the bathing room, which leads straight into one of the drainage ditches that connects to the central sewer system of the city. So they knew exactly what they were doing. They understood the importance of having clean water that was potable and keeping it separate from their wastewater. Because of this, we can kind of guess that they also thought about bathing as an important thing, so maybe ritual cleanliness. Archaeology teachers have always said, in college, that if the archaeologists got to the site and they saw something and they didn't exactly know what the reason was for it being there, that they would almost automatically give it a magical or a religious reason for existing. So Maybe the bathing was related to ritual purposes or something religious, but maybe it could have just been that these people wanted to be clean and they don't want to go clean themselves in the river, which they were going to use the water from to, drink and bathe in and water their plants with. I don't know. We'll never know. But on the topic of bathing, one of the big archaeological finds in Mohenjo-Daro is that of the Great Central Bath. And so there is a large bathing complex, and there are pillars all around this one pool. And the pool is pretty big. It's about 8 feet deep at its deepest point, 40 feet in length, and about 25 feet wide. So this is a pretty big pool. And they thought, okay, maybe it's used by the priest for, ritual purposes, something like that, because you don't really need a big public bath if people have bathrooms in their own houses. So maybe this is actually for purely religious purposes. And now when you go into the bigger Hindu temples in India, there's usually a water pool which is used for religious purposes. So they are obviously drawing on current information about Hinduism. These people weren't necessarily Hindu. They were practicing a religion that no longer exists or may exist only in semblances in modern Hinduism, or kind of pieces of it might have drifted into and become part of the Vedic religion that came later. But they really don't know why this bath was used, so they're piecing together information about the people themselves, the city, the archaeological information at the site, and modern Hinduism. So maybe it is for religious purposes. But most of the houses had their own bathrooms, and like I said, all those drainage pipes connected to the central sewer, so it probably wasn't like a Roman bath where you would go to hang out with your friends and bathe for half the day. No, it just doesn't seem like one of those things. The Indus Valley people were also traders, so they had a very complex system of weight, distance, and time measurement. Now, the system wasn't standardized, so a foot here in Mohenjo-Daro would be different from what is considered a foot in Harappa, but they knew that, they had to measure these things out because they were trading with these other civilizations, so the people who were out west, and so the Iranians, the present-day Iranians, and they were shipping things to them by means of boats and, carts. So there was a lot of trade going on, and they had a very complex measurement system. So we found, well, archaeologists have found little weights and scales and things like that, which are very, systematically made. And that's kind of cool. They had a concept of time, they had a concept of sizes and things like that. I mean, if you're going to build an amazing city like that with architecture that's going to last for over 1,000 years, your engineers must be knowing what they're doing while they're doing it, right? Anyway, another few important archaeological artifacts that are found at the site. These things will pop up. If you Google Mohenjo-Daro or the Harappan site, you'll see pictures of the ruins of the site, but then you'll also see pictures of these artifacts. So the first one I'm going to talk about, because a lot of old archaeologists who were excavating the site when it was first found, they were obsessed with it. This is the small bronze statue of a dancing girl, and it's maybe about seven, no, it's about 6 inches tall, and all these archaeologists were obsessed with it. So, for example, there were two different archaeologists who worked on excavating the site. First one was John Marshall, and after him, the person in charge of the Archaeological Survey of India was Mortimer Wheeler, who was married to Dame Agatha Christie. So if you've read any of the Hercule Poirot books or Miss Marple, that old lady who knits but then also figures out who did the murder, well, her husband, so Agatha Christie's husband, was the second archaeologist who was working on the site. And about this statue, he said, She's about 15 years old, I should think. Not more, but she stands there with bangles all the way up her arm and nothing else on. A girl who is perfectly, for the moment, perfectly confident of herself and the world. There's nothing like her, I think, in the world. Okay, that's kind of obsessive about a little, tiny bronze statue. But it's really cool because it showed archaeologists that this ancient civilization had an idea of art. They were able to create forms of the human body. This girl actually looks like a girl. And they were able to mix metals. Metallurgy was a skill that they had. So this is, it's cool on multiple levels. Yes, if you're obsessed with the art about the girl, okay. But as a civilization, they were looking pretty advanced. The second artifact that's pretty important is one of this old man who is wearing a robe and he has his eyes half closed. It's just a bust, so it's from his upper torso and his head. And so he has this, you know, band on his forehead, his hair is slicked back, and they think he's a priest because he's wearing robes and he looks like he's in a half meditative state. Once again, this is one of those things that no one will ever actually know the answer to. Maybe he was a priest, or maybe he was another important person in the history of that of the Indus Valley civilization, but archaeologists, when in doubt, give something a religious reason or a religious purpose. So there you have it. Finally, the most important artifact or artifacts found at these sites are the seals. So they had, the Indus Valley people had a system of writing, and it's still undeciphered. There are symbols, there are so many different types of these symbols. There are 400 different patterns that have been found and recorded, and they're found all over the Indus Valley sites, but they're also found in the Middle East, which shows us two things. First, that the Indus Valley people were traders. They were trading with their Middle Eastern neighbors, and second, these seals may have had a role in the trade process themselves. So on the backs of these seals, there are these small stone squares, maybe about an inch square. And on the back, there is a little loop cut into the stone, and there's a hole that is bored through that little bump. And it looks like something that you would, you know, put on a string and tie onto something or something like that. So maybe these seals were marking the value of something or who they were coming from and where they were going, things like that. We'll never know because there are very beautiful pictures that are carved on the seals, as well as letters or what are assumed to be words, but we'll never know what they mean until someone deciphers the Indus Valley script. Among these, though, is one seal that is very popular and very important. And this has been called the Pashupati seal. Pashupati means lord of the beasts. So Pashu means animals or beasts, and Pati means the lord. And when you look at it, I'm sure you'll find a picture of it on when you Google Mohenjo-Daro or Indus Valley artifacts. What you see on the seal is a man who is sitting in a yogic posture called Siddhasana, now that yoga has been established. So they have a name for it, so Siddhasana, and he has a headdress on with what looks like two oxen horns on it. He's also surrounded by all these different animals. So there's a rhinoceros, an elephant, an ox, and a tiger, which is why he's called Pashupati. But he's also shown with an erect phallus, right? So sitting in this meditative state, he's shown with an erect phallus, which is probably a symbol of fertility. But in Hinduism today, Shaivites, or people who worship Shiva, worship him in a different form called the Lingam, and there are some Indologists who believe that this is a phallic symbol, and the archaeologists at that time interpreted this man sitting in a meditative posture, which Shiva is the greatest yogic master in all of history, right? So, or he is believed to be. So they gave him the name of Shiva, and this erect phallus also added on to that, perhaps as a precursor to the linga or the lingam itself. And So the three different things. So one, of him sitting in the yogic posture, two, all the animals surrounding him, and then three, the erect phallus, gave archaeologists enough evidence to kind of guess that he was related to Shiva or Rudra, which is a form of Shiva that comes up in the Rig Veda. So once again, there are also characters written on this tile, but no one can translate it, so we don't know what it actually stands for. So that was just a little bit about the people themselves, the city, and some, major, I think, points that you have to hit on when you talk about that civilization. But then the civilization began to fail. So in around 1800 BC, the Indus Valley sites went into decline. The reasons for this are still technically unknown, but there are two main hypotheses. The first of these, and the older of these, is called the Aryan invasion theory, which was formulated by the British archaeologists who were excavating the site back in the 1920s, because that's when John Marshall first began working on the site. And that the Aryan invasion theory suggests that there was a great war that was waged on these Indus Valley peoples, mainly by these Aryan invaders who came in wanting to conquer and take over the land. So I said the word Aryan, so let me go and talk a bit more about it, because most people know this term, unfortunately, with relation to Hitler and the Nazis. But the term originated from ancient Iranian, and Hitler definitely stole it from history books that he was reading. The word originally referred to the early Iranians, so the ancient Iranians themselves gave themselves that name. And interestingly, if you know about the ancient Persian Empire, so Darius the First, who was the father of Xerxes, that Persian emperor who fought the Spartans in like the 300 movie and all that, which was extremely inaccurate, but I'll leave that to a classicist to rant about. Anyway, so Darius the First, he labeled himself in carvings in different places, in epigraphies, as an Achaemenid. So the Achaemenid comes from ancient Persian. So the Achaemenid, a Persian, the son of a Persian, and finally, an Aryan of Aryan descent, meaning the term Aryan itself refers to the people of ancient Iran or Persia. And that was the name that he gave to his race. So anyway, the word came over to Sanskrit, and in Sanskrit it referred to these Vedic Indo-Aryans, who Indo-Iranian or Aryans who came into the northwestern part of ancient India with their language Sanskrit or some sort of a precursor to it, and also they brought their Vedic culture, and it came to be defined in Sanskrit as noble. And this is probably where Hitler got his idea for creating his noble race of Nazis or noble race of men. But I digress. That's for American historians to talk about. The Aryan invasion theory was that when they came into India, waged war on the Indus Valley cities, that they took over the Indus Valley people, forced the survivors to assimilate into their Aryan culture, which spoke the Sanskrit precursor language, and performed fire sacrifices, which are very, very important. We'll go into that a bit later. And that is also an aspect of Avestan religion, which is the ancient Iranian religion that lived on into Vedic religion and is still part of modern Hinduism today. So it's very, very important. The Indus Valley civilization people are believed to have spoken a different ancient language, and that is thought to be some sort of a Dravidian language precursor. So you have the two different mother languages of modern India. You have the Indo-Iranian or the Romantic Sanskrit language, and then you have the Dravidian language, which came up and which existed before the Iranians came in and still lives on in the southern part of India. Interestingly, you can kind of track how the language moved through India. So first, you get the influx from the northwest, And you can see how Sanskrit and Sanskrit-based modern Indian languages are mainly spread out in the northern and the central part of India. But in the south, it's mainly Dravidian languages. So that kind of gives you an idea of how the language has shifted. But in the northeastern part, there are still pockets where a Dravidian-based language is spoken. So maybe this idea of not the Aryan invasion happening with a great war and everything, but the Aryan invasion with a linguistic twist on it most likely did occur, because there are Dravidian language speakers in the north, and they're kind of cut off and surrounded by all these Sanskritic-based language speakers. So that's really interesting. Now, this theory also was based on the Vedic texts. So when these archaeologists were going through the archaeological evidence, they were also asking, okay, what is the history of these people? And the oldest text that they could find, which they kind of took as a history textbook, were the Vedas. And in the Rig Veda, there is a great war that's mentioned between the Aryans and the Dasyus, who are assumed to be the Indus Valley people. So the Aryans were the great noble race that came in and wiped out the Dasyus. And so this was also part of their evidence pool for coming to the conclusion of an Aryan war, an Aryan invasion. But now, with modern archaeological evidence, and I'm sure with a lot of GIS data, this idea of just a war or an invasion, it's kind of falling to the side a little bit, and a new theory about climate change is coming to light. The area that was once so fertile along the Indus River, so that whole valley, eventually rain patterns started to shift, and that region didn't receive as much rainfall as it used to. So that annual flooding, just like the flooding of the Nile, that annual flooding didn't really happen anymore, and the Indus Valley people didn't know irrigation techniques. So they just relied on the flood to occur and the rains to occur. The monsoon season was very, very important. But eventually these extended monsoons moved from the western part, and as climate shift occurred, it went over to the eastern part of India instead. And this once very populated region wasn't habitable anymore. But then the influx of the Aryans somehow connected perfectly. The timing worked out perfectly. So the rise of Aryan culture and the rise of the Vedas and all that lines up perfectly with the time that the Indus Valley civilization fell. So it's easy to see why these early archaeologists thought that the two events were connected. Sir John Marshall, who, as I said earlier, was the first to do the digs here, he actually discovered both the Mohenjo-Daro and the Harappan city sites, and he did the best that he could to piece the story together based on the evidence that he had. So we can't be too mad at him, but archaeology is a science, and with time, the techniques are improving and the theories change as new evidence is found, just like they do in biology or chemistry or whatever other science. And we should be grateful that he even rediscovered this site. Sadly, a lot of the artifacts that were found by early archaeologists were done so kind of like Indiana Jones. It was a cool, adventurous, it was the heyday of Western archaeology, right? So it was a white man colonizing the world. The English loved this. This was Victorian era England. You would go in and you would colonize these people, learn their language a little bit, and then you would go to see if they had any gold so you could send it back to the queen and please her. Or you could, and this happened way too often, and it's really sad because a lot of the archaeological evidence was lost. People would go and they would go to these different sites and they would dig up something cool and they would say, oh, great, and they would just pull it out of the site. And then they would, you know, sell it for a lot of money to a rich person somewhere in England or somewhere in America. And they would go and sit in these curiosity museums, which were people's private collections of cool things from around the world. But these cool things were also usually very, very ancient. And were part of a history of a people. And it wasn't until much later when archaeology stopped becoming stopped being a looting business and became more of a scientific thing. So, for example, when the earlier sites in this valley were found, so Mohenjo-Daro and Harappa, the British were building a railroad all the way across India because they needed to ship themselves and their stuff and people. They were building public transportation, and they needed some bricks to level the land. And where do you think they took the bricks from? Well, they took them from these sites. They took them from the walls and the buildings, and they were just ruins anyway. And they took the bricks and they built their railroads. And now that's really, really sad because they probably took down entire buildings or entire city walls, which could have told us a lot about the civilization itself, right? So even when you take an artifact from a site, back then it was like treasure hunting, but what's more important sometimes than the artifact itself is where it was found, because its location can tell you so much more about the way it was used or what was happening when it was deposited there. Anyway, that's really depressing that they probably took apart entire walls of these ancient cities to build their railroads. But on the plus side, these Indus Valley people must have been very brilliant because they made bricks that lasted 3.8 millennia, which is a really long time, and they were still usable by the British to make train tracks. So it was a civilization that wasn't planning on going anywhere anytime soon, but obviously they disappeared. Now, what about the Aryans? They spoke a language that was predominantly spoken in present-day Iran, right, so in ancient Iran, and they are believed to have been pretty civilized. But they didn't have a big city or a center from which they were working. They were really powerful, mainly because of their high mobility. They had lots of cattle, they had wagons to carry all their stuff in, and they had horse-drawn chariots. They had horses. So this gave them a lot more power than these Indus Valley people or most other people who were in that region of the world at that time, because horses meant you could get places faster, you could travel faster, and fighting on horseback is a lot more effective than sending in foot soldiers. So the horse, I think, is the most important thing to focus on here. The horse had a very important role for these Aryans, both economically, right, so as tools of power, but then also as religious animals. So in the Veda, in the Rig Veda, the horse is mentioned many times, and it's seen as this very important creature. And one aspect in which it's very important is in one of the sacrifices that is made. And this is the greatest sacrifice that can be made by any living man. And in fact, it's so great that it can only be made by the king. And this was called the Ashwamedha Yagna. And this was a sacrifice that the king would make in order to show that he commanded all the lands, not just his kingdom, but all the lands around him, and to bring great favor from the gods. And it's a long process to explain what the sacrifice is, so I'll do that in the next podcast when we go into more of the religious stuff. But there is a big debate over what it actually was. So a yagna is a fire sacrifice, and earlier in its practice, it may have actually been where a horse was burnt at the stake, but later it's thought to have shifted into a more ritualistic and symbolic rite, and maybe horses weren't actually killed off. But I'm going to talk about that in a later podcast when we can go into more depth about it. The Aryans also had a patriarchal society, right? And they lived, and this aspect of it lived on into Vedic society as time progressed. And it takes on the role of the male householder, or the yajaman. And in Vedic sacrificial rites, the householder, or the eldest male in the family, the yajaman, is responsible for holding the sacrifice and maintaining and inviting the priest to his house to perform the sacrifice in order to bring good health to his family. And by performing these sacrifices, keeping order in the universe. That is a man's duty, other than earning a livelihood for his family. And the Aryans also had a very complex religious system and pantheon, and their deities lived on into Vedic religion and mythology as well. So gods like Indra, who is the king of the gods, and he's very Zeus-like in that he's the god of the heavens, right? Just like Zeus. He is in charge of rain and thunder and things like that. So he lived on. And Agni, who is the god of fire, and he is crucial because he is the fire sacrifice itself. And in Aryan theology, both of them were very important, and I just named two of the many gods that are mentioned in the Rig Veda. But Agni and Indra were crucial to Vedic religion, and they both lived on into modern Hinduism and also before modern Hinduism into Vedic theology. Now, the Aryans had a systematic way of writing that was some sort of a precursor to Sanskrit, and it was found by the Western archaeologists to be linguistically connected with Greek and Latin based on their grammatical structure, and a lot of the roots that, so for example, the word Agni itself. Agni in Sanskrit means fire, but in Latin you get the word ignis, meaning fire as well. So it's the roots for a lot of the words are the same, and this usually shows some sort of relationship between the peoples themselves. Now, the reason that the Aryans actually came into northwestern India is unknown. So if they were, you know, looting and pillaging and taking over people in the other part of the world, why did they even bother coming into India? Well, it's believed that the Aryans, we know, were a mainly pastoralist society. So they had these cattle, and they would kind of follow their cattle wherever they went because they relied on them. And so maybe their cattle just kept moving east because that's where the grass was growing. And as the Aryans came in, they came to this site, or, you know, this river valley that was no longer inhabited by these people. Anyway, based on this linguistic evidence, we can assume that Sanskrit was brought into India by these Indo-Aryans, and subsequently the Vedas were composed by these same people, because many of the gods in the Vedas are the same, and the language in which they're composed is a very, very ancient form of Sanskrit itself. But you can see, I guess now, through reading or through hearing about all this prehistorical information about India, I think you understand why it's so crucial that we get through this before actually getting into the texts themselves. The religion of Hinduism didn't have its roots in the Indus Valley civilization, right? None of the subsequent schools of philosophy or religions that came from India came from the Indus Valley people. They came from these migrants who were coming in from ancient Iran or somewhere around there. And even though pieces of the Indus Valley religion may have snuck into or become assimilated into the Vedic theology that the Aryans had, the majority of it came from the Aryans. And they flourished in northern India, and they finally settled down and started their civilizations there. So that's why I thought it was important to give you this kind of a primer on ancient Indian history and prehistory before we got into analyzing the texts. In the next episode, we'll take a look at the Vedas themselves, all four of them, a very abbreviated run through of what's in them and what's most important about each of them. And we'll talk a little bit about why they're so important to 9.6 million Hindus, practicing Hindus, all over the world today. But then also how this religious set of texts lay the groundwork for the rest of Indian philosophy. Well, that wraps up this episode of Philosoph India. Remember to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, and thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time.